gratitude is one of those missing elements that's so needed and yet so forgotten.
I had to catch up on some reading during the weekend. I have to say, after reading it, I start thanking everyone. I'm Dr. Eli Daher, and each episode, we dive into the journey of some of the world's most recognized leaders. Adrian has authored multiple books, him and his partner, Chester Elton, and has sold more than 3 million copies worldwide.
People don't promote themselves very much. So they become the best engineer at XYZ firm, but nobody knows that.
Oh, I'm stuck where I am. I'm not growing. I'm not learning. I'm doing the same thing. What do you think of that?
So it's not just what you're good at. Do you like doing it? And is there a market for it? Those three have to come together. Take 1 hour a week and work on your next thing. And be the best that you can be where you exist.
This kind of giving first and then receiving after, I think that's also key.
It has to begin with, I want to give. I don't want to just get. And people will sense that about you if you're a giver. I love that you said that. Life is short. Make sure your work matters. And find a place where you can feel valued, you feel like you're making a difference, and you feel like you're recognized for the work that you contribute.
So welcome to Reimagining You, the podcast where we explore the power of personal branding, thought leadership, and the strategies that help professionals transition, establish authority, and create lasting influence. I'm Dr. Eli Daher, and each episode, we dive into the journey of some of the world's most recognized leaders, unpacking how they build their brand, claim credibility, and turn their expertise into impact. So today, I'm honored to welcome one of the most influential voices in leadership and workplace culture, Adrian Gostick. Good morning, Adrian.
Hello. Good evening there. Good morning for me.
Great. So just for people to introduce Adrian, Adrian has authored multiple books, New York bestseller. Him and his partner, Chester Elton. Some of the books are very well known, like The Carrot Principle, The All In, Leading with Gratitude, and Anxiety at Work. Their work has been translated into more than 30 languages and has sold more than 3 million copies worldwide. Of course, they've been featured in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and Forbes. But today, we're going beyond leadership and workplace culture. We're diving into their personal journey of becoming global recognized thought leaders. So we're going to dive in with Adrian. Thank you, Adrian, for accepting the invitation to be on our show.
Thanks. No, this is such an important subject. I'm so glad you've written the book, Reimagining You, and that you do this podcast. I'm thrilled to be here, Eli.
Great. But before diving, I have to be honest with you, and I have a confession. So in order to prepare for this podcast, I had to catch up on some reading during the weekend. So I dove into Leading with Gratitude. And I have to say, after reading it, I start thanking everyone, from my Uber driver to my barista, to even my neighbor's dog that, you know, he was so kind not to wake me up at 5 a.m. in the morning with his bark. So thank you for eliminating the subject of gratitude for leadership.
Oh, thanks. That's great. That's how we started. We started writing the book with our mentor, Marshall Goldsmith, who wrote, What Got You Here Won't Get You There. And one of the things that Marshall told us, he says, every executive that I ever have coached, he says, forgets gratitude. We get to a certain point in our progress, a certain height in the corporation, and we just forget all the people who have lifted us there. And so gratitude is one of those missing elements that's so needed and yet so forgotten.
Excellent. Well said. Well, let's start with you, Adrian. I mean, you were an employee before, you worked in organizations. How did you discover your mission? your mission that you could have contribution to the world, you could claim authority in the subject, and you wanted to branch out and start on that track?
Well, my background, I was a vice president of investor relations with a 10,000 person bank, and in my 20s, and I was hard charging, and I thought I was gonna, you know, set great great things there, and our bank actually went through, we bought 30 other banks during the time I was there. So I became a little bit of an M&A culture expert, bringing cultures together. And what happens when you're in 30 mergers and acquisitions in 3 years is eventually your bank gets bought. And that's what happened. So as our bank got gobbled up by another financial institution, I had a call from a recruiter, and I decided I'm going to get out of banking. And I went to work for a consultancy that did employee engagement work around the world. And I met my co-author, Chester Elton. And I was just their vice president of corporate communications. I wasn't expecting to write books. But this is a little of your work, as I started reimagining my future while I was still within the corporate world. And Chester and I, we wrote a couple of books while we were at the organization. They did quite well. And we said, we had a little ennui while we were there. We had all the things that maybe Dan Pink in his book Drive says you should have. We had mastery. We had autonomy. But we were not happy. And we weren't happy because we didn't own our work. And we were hired guns for the corporation, sending us wherever they wanted. And we wanted to work a little deeper with some companies. We wanted to go into a new world of culture where they wanted to stay back and do, you know, employee engagement, employee recognition, things like that. But we wanted to write about culture and bigger things. And so we went off on our own about 2011, January of 2011. And we wrote the book All In and launched our world. And I could tell you more about that, but it's been an exciting journey that's taken us to I think every continent except Antarctica. It's been fantastic.
Very nice story. And in fact, if we think about our audience, be a lot of executives, they're thinking about the same thing because they are in the comfort trap with their business card, their title, and a company they're attached to. And every time I meet with friends, coworkers, I hear, oh, I'm stuck where I am. I'm not growing. I'm not learning. I'm doing the same thing. But they are in a comfort zone. They've got bills to pay. They've got responsibility to take care of. And they're difficult for them to take the leap and start somewhere. So with you and Chester, sounds like you find the right opportunity because you build it on from your expertise at work. So I had a pleasure to have a podcast with another person that really has resonated something with me. Stay in your lane. So when you want to do something and branch out, try to stay within your lane. This is what you know. This is what you have claimed authority, or you could claim authority. So continue on that momentum rather than going into food and beverage, for example, or into pharmaceuticals. What do you think of that?
I think it's exactly right. It's, you know, somebody who is a head of procurement for a big company is not all of a sudden going to become a heart surgeon. It's not going to happen. And so the point is stay in, and I love that lay of the, you stay in your swim lane is so if you, like, for example, with us, we were working in business consulting within this organization. Well, that's what we're still doing, but we've broadened that too. It doesn't mean that you have to continue, you know, if you're say in procurement that you always have to do that as a consultant. But you're still going to be in something. Maybe you become an importer, exporter, or there's something that you're going to be doing to use that skill set that you have built up versus starting over. So that's the question is, what can you, as you analyze yourself, you say, okay, what am I missing right now in my workplace that's leaving me unfulfilled, that I'm not growing, and really identifying what your motivators are. For me, it's very much about creativity. Time with family is very important to me. Autonomy is very important to me. Chester is very different. His top motivators are friendship, being social with others, and recognition. He loves to be recognized. And so we've built a partnership over the last 20 years at a company that allows me to work more autonomously, be creative, have time with the family when I'm done in the afternoons. Where Chester, right now, he's on a plane flying to another conference because he loves to be around people. You'd send him to a conference, he's going to come back with 20 people, their business cards, that I never would have met because he's a lot more social, but that's what drives him. So it's not just what you're good at, that's your swim lane, but it's the Venn diagram. Are you good at it and do you like doing it? And the third part of the Venn diagram is there a market for it? Those three have to come together.
Perfectly said, perfectly said. And then of course, you have to define whether you are the right person. Means, you know, if you can claim authority into that place, if you are, and people would entrust you with the information that you're giving, right? So obviously from your experience, you came up with that naturally. But for the audience that we have, it might be specifically for the young generation, right? I'm looking at the entrepreneurs. They're going to attract investors. They talk to, you know, potential customers. And they don't have a track record. They didn't build authority for themselves on that subject. So what do you think? What is equivalent to authority for them? How can they do it?
You know, and authority is such an interesting, because I think you're exactly right, Ellie. What we find, credibility is built in two ways. One is you become good at something, and that you're, You build up expertise in this area that is my area. The second is that people recognize you for having that authority. That's harder.
Yes.
Yeah. And so credibility is built in two ways. And the problem is somebody, especially with technical, engineering, financial roles that are not very, public facing, if you will, people don't promote themselves very much. So they may become the best engineer at XYZ firm, but nobody knows that. So,
absolutely.
And so there's a trick in promotion that's not too heavy-handed, where look at me, I'm so great, patting yourself on the back, but also not so much that you go, oh, I'm just one of the many engineers. No, you talk about, you know, I was working on this great project, and you tell the story of this project, and in a way, you're talking about how good you are without really telling people how good you are. So there are ways to do this that are subtle, but you have to remember there's two ways there. Now you're also asking, okay, what if I don't have, you know, I'm not the CEO of this or the, you know, the managing director of this firm. And I have people that come up to me after one of my speaking engagements, they'll say, oh, I'd love to do what you do. And I say, well, where are you right now? And they'll say, well, I'm director of the call center at Kuwaiti Bank. And I said, great. Then go be the best director of call center at Kuwaiti Bank that they've ever had, and come up with stories and find ways to engage your people. That's where you begin, is you find the credibility where you are and be the best that you can be where you exist.
Well done. Well done. That's a great advice. So you talked about the difference between you and Chester in terms of social network, and you with the work-life balance or the family time. So I'm going to talk about network, because that's another change, if you want to say. If you're in the corporate world, your network is in conferences, in with your colleagues, with your customers. And this is an exchange of business cards. I was talking to other podcast guests that I had. They classify and they categorize their network. And really, it's all about engaging the network to leverage them to propagate your knowledge and then to actually learn also from them. And that becomes an interaction and an engagement. So, I know Chester, for example, if you look at his LinkedIn, he has 560,000 followers, you know?
Yeah. God bless him. I think I have almost 20,000 and I feel like, oh, no, nobody knows me.
So what do you think? What do you think the difference here? I mean, you know, Chester looks like, obviously, he likes that amount of followers and the engagement. But I mean, you're equally happy and successful. So how do we compare notes?
Great question. It's really what drives you as well, what you're looking for. Chester thrives on that kind of connection. After he lands on this flight, I just texted with him before he was sitting on the plane. I was texting him. When he lands, he'll text me and he'll say, I met the greatest guy sitting next to me. You know, it's like, who do you meet on a plane? You know, nowadays everybody's, you know, head down, but he will, and he'll spend 2 hours talking to this person, whacking him in the arm and saying, telling him stuff and getting their story. And so that's what drives him. So networking, now for me, like I said, I'm quite happy to work on my computer and, you know, chat with a few clients in the day and really dive deep and not be a social butterfly. So Chester's pushed me as well. When, like, for instance, when we were back at the corporate days, he would say, look, go have lunch with a different person each day from one of your peers, one of the other vice presidents in the organization. And I go, I don't want to do that. And they go, no, do it. And it was so good for me. And, you know, and I went and forced myself to do it. And so sometimes getting out of our comfort zone is very good. And that's what he's encouraged me to do as well. So, you know, if I'm at a conference, I'm looking for stories. I'm meeting people. I'm being more social than I normally would be. And for him, because he meets so many people, I try to force him to say, okay, now follow up with them. You know, and both are important, you know, because he'll just jump to the next person. And he goes, you're right. I met Ellie the other day. I need to go back and ask him. And sometimes those turn into wonderful long-term relationships, but you've got to let them build as well. So, yeah, the point is, right, get out of your comfort zone, go network with people outside of your organization, your company, and but you can still be in the swim lane, but those are the people you are going to be using when you make the leap to your independence or your retirement or where you want other work.
Very good. You know, I think the for networking perspective, I think it's good to start now and expand your network and your sphere of influence and your sphere of engagement beyond your business, beyond your customers. I mean, I would encourage our audience to go and be part of the community, go on a town hall, go to startup meetings, mentor somebody if you have experience. And this is a great way, volunteer somewhere if you can, that you'll meet a lot of people everywhere. And you're absolutely right. You can leverage this network later on for engagement or pure relationship. Professional relationship or business relationship that you can monetize later on, or you can leverage when you leave. Absolutely. I wish I am working on that too. You know, that's why I tried to reach you. I leveraged a friend of ours that introduced me to you.
And it's amazing. Yeah. Just those friendships that because it was CB Bowman who runs a big coaching consultancy. And she said, hey, you've got to meet Ellie. And I was like, hey, CB, if you say we're going to be friends, we are. And so, yeah. Yes. The problem is sometimes, like I just got an email this weekend from somebody at Chevron, a big company. He's about to retire and he wants to do coaching. And he says, okay, where should I begin? I was like, you should have been doing this months ago. So, yeah. But I give him some names. You know, the point is, do this now. Don't wait, because people think, well, I'm so busy now. It's like, no, you know, take 1 hour a week. That's all. Just 1 hour a week and work on your next thing. That's a simple step that you can do And may, like you said, maybe it's a networking event. Maybe it's meet going to taking somebody to lunch that who's doing this independently, like yourself, or whatever it is. 1 hour a week, devote to your next thing.
Absolutely. And thank you for that, because Reimagining You book is all about the 10 steps that walk you through from, you know, from finding your mission to your unique value, claiming credibility, identifying your tone of voice, your communication way, and then go build your digital presence, your physical presence, your network, and then monetize on that. So this is a great segue into my book. Thank you. We should advise your friend to buy my book when it is launched, right? Very good. So let's segue a little bit into how did you become New York bestseller in your book? And that's a challenge because, you know, for a lot of people that publish, and I know I met Dr. Marshall one day, you know, we're also colleagues as well, and he's a great mentor. He wrote my book forward as well. And he, you know, I asked him, how do I become New York bestseller? And it was a long answer, but
it's quite an answer.
Exactly. Yeah, so how do you?
Yeah, and I'm actually ghostwriting a book for Marshall right now. So yeah, Marshall and I speak quite often. Marshall Goldsmith, for anybody who's listening who doesn't know him. So take you back a little bit, give you a little story since we have a little time, but I think it's a fun one. So so when Chester and I started working together for this health consultancy, but it was a pretty big company. They had about, I think about the time, 1,700 employees. So it's a mid-sized company. And I was their VP of communications. He was running sales up in the Northeast and of the U.S. And he was working with some really cool companies like Johnson & Johnson and others who were doing some really creative things with engaging their employees. And he says, we should write a book. And I was like, oh, okay, write a book, huh? And he says, yeah, you're the writer guy. I'm the idea guy. Well, let's come together. So we wrote this book. The company allowed us to put it out. We went and found a publisher. Like a little publisher in the state of Utah in U.S. They just had done small books before, but we met on a park bench outside of their barn that they had their publishing house in, and we signed the contract. We had no idea it was that easy. And we ended up selling 40,000 copies of that little book. And we thought, well, that's about normal. They said, no. That's like rock star. Yeah, he said, if a book sells like 5,000 copies, it's a hit. You've done 8 times that. So we said, okay. And they said, what else you got? And we said, I don't know. We thought that was it. We write the book and then we can be consultants. And they said, no, give me more. So allegorical stories were quite big at the time. Patrick Lencioni and others were writing these kind of fables. So we wrote a little fable book called The 24 Carat Manager using the carrot theme. Okay. And it did really well around the world, actually. It sold pretty well in the U.S., but around the world, like China, it sold hundreds of thousands of copies in China. And we were over there speaking quite often. And so Chester one day was speaking in China, and thousands of people had come out to watch him. And there was a New York Times reporter in the audience. So a reporter from the New York Times. And the next day on the front page of the business section was a story about Chester Elton in China being mobbed by thousands of people treating him like a rock star. And the headline was, you know, all these people flocking to see Chester Elton. And it says, Chester who? Question mark. And we got a call that day from a famous editor at Simon & Schuster, a big publisher in the U.S. in New York. His name was Fred Hills. And he had discovered a little guy by the name of Stephen Covey. The Seven Habits, right? You know that. So he had discovered him and Marcus Buckingham and others. And so he says, hey, what's happening to you in China? We can do for you around the world. Publish with us. So we did our next book, a data-driven book you mentioned, The Carrot Principle, with Simon Schuster. And so a few things happened. So how do you get a New York Times seller is we'd already written several books that had done fairly well. We'd built up our reputation. We wrote a really good book with them that they challenged and they pushed us, and they made it data driven. And so we actually found some unique data that they, you know, Willis Towers Watson allowed us to use. It was proprietary for the book. We did a big media push. We were on every station you could imagine. We had a saying of five things a day we would do. We would be on a podcast. We would do an interview. We would write an article for something. Five things every day. We also had a network of people around the world that we asked to promote it, which was a huge as well, because at that time, 2010, 2011, social media was just getting started. So people would promote the book, our friends. So there was a whole thing, you know, list of things that we did to promote it, to get it out there. We also, consultants ourselves, we called in every favor we could. Any client, we would ask them, hey, buy 200 copies and we will come speak for you, or whatever it was, buy 500 copies and in lieu of, and they did. And so things started happening. And the first week, I think we sold 13,000 copies of the book. You know, within a year, we'd sold 100,000 copies of that book, and it kept selling. And the Carrot Principle, I think, has now sold over 600,000 copies. And in 2022, I think it was, we reissued the book as Leading with Gratitude. So we redid the book, new data, new stories, and we called it Leading with Gratitude, because gratitude is bigger than just recognition. Mm, mm. So anyway, so long story, that's how we got there. But it's been a fun ride.
Well, I love the story. I love the story. And it's resilience is persistence, is a lot of movement between digital and physical that you require, and a lot of focus too. So for our audience, once you claim authority, you know your mission, you claim authority, you have your unique value, and you establish the tone of voice you want to have, then the next is to really go into the visible. So go with the social media, and you'll have a different strategy, maybe work through LinkedIn, through different medium, YouTube, whatever that the right medium that would serve your purpose. And of course, there is a lot of physical artifacts. You talked about podcasts, but you talked about conferences, you talk about speaking engagement, trading off between, okay, for you was, okay, I'll give you a certain amount of books and we'll come speak, or you'll buy a certain amount of books and we'll come speak. So this kind of giving first and then receiving after, I think that's also key, that I've learned from you and from other guests that I had. So that's a very good point.
I love that. I wonder, build on, because you're exactly right, Ellie. People know when it's only in it for you, right? I mean, they just smell it on you. But if I'm giving, if I'm like, you know, I mean, right now I'm here to help you with your podcast, and I want it, but in turn, you're promoting me, and it's wonderful, but it has to begin with, I want to give. I don't want to just get. And people will sense that about you if you're a giver. I love that you said that.
Yes. And as you acquire this knowledge, and you become, you know, one of the senior leaders in this world, I think our role, and I'm pretty old age, if you want to say, in terms of I've got 45 plus years of corporate world. So one thing that I start behaving is I become a coach to the people rather than managing the people. So by coaching is, I'm giving them, I'm mentoring them as well. And that's the first sign, and you give back your knowledge. So I want to go into giving back the knowledge and talk a bit about the knowledge economy and the attention economy a bit, because that could impact our senior audience versus the younger audience. So today, you know, I live in the knowledge economy. I acquired knowledge from school, university, workplace, experience. And then this is what I know what to do, right? So when somebody comes and asks me, I give him back my experience and my knowledge. If I look at different crafts, such as doctors or lawyers, so the most famous doctor in the world might have an exposure to about 500 to 600 MRIs, 1,000 MRIs, with all the tests, let's say, for a serious illness. And based on his experience, based on, you know, all the data and demographic that he had, he could advise on the, you know, the course of treatment. So let's take two doctors, Dr. A and Dr. B. They're both famous. They both have the same amount of knowledge of MRIs and exposure and whatever. With the age of AI today, any doctor can beat that, in fact, because they could go and upload that MRI for their particular patient with the respective tests, with the relevant tests, and an AI will go through 50,000 MRIs and then compare and give you diagnostic, which could be a bit more accurate than, you know, the most famous doctor. So here I'm democratizing, or, you know, commoditizing knowledge. So what will happen to these doctors, or to the lawyers, in a matter of fact, because the same thing applies. And here I would bring in the attention economy, or the attention economy, right? Because what differentiates Dr. A to Dr. B is not their knowledge anymore. It'll be their emotional intelligence, their adaptability, their creativity. So they look at the patient, they look at his needs or her needs, has money that could go somewhere to pay, or have no insurance, have children, have a dynamic lifestyle where they have to travel for work, or they're sitting at home. So with these perspectives, the doctor can apply emotional intelligence and can advise on the course of action. So that's Dr. A. Dr. B could probably have little emotional intelligence and will follow the book by the gold standard, and this is how you treat a patient. So that shifts from the knowledge economy to the attention economy, where emotional intelligence, adaptability, and creativity is key. And that's where the younger generation is coming. So for me, as a senior person, I have to unlearn a lot and start engaging with more emotions and more creativity, and embrace the unlearning and relearn again from the young minds. So I'm opening this parenthesis. I want to listen to your views on that, because it's important to illuminate or have some light on the subject, particularly for the senior executives that are looking to leave, stay in their lane, and then take their knowledge forward and start monetizing on that knowledge, where this knowledge could be replaced.
It's such an important and good question, and I by no means profess to be, you know, the expert on this, other than, you know, you and I are old enough to have seen trends come before. I was working in journalism when the internet came around, and everybody predicted that newspapers would be dead within, you know, 3 or 4 years. Well, yeah, they eventually did change. They're still online, but print took about, you know, 30 years to fade out. And because the generation wanted it, they wanted to keep holding things on the subway as they were riding into work or whatever it was, and that tactile feel. So things do change quite slowly, but there's also, and they do eventually happen, but there's always going to be a need for humanity. And so what AI is starting to do, you're exactly right. So, for example, I could, you know, somebody could write a book today with AI. It's terrible. It looks like, you know, you've just hired a, you know, college first year or university first year student to do it. And it's boring and it's repetitive, but it'll get better. It doesn't mean it, you know, they'll get better and better with this. So what do we bring as humans is exactly what you're saying, is it's your empathy. It's your ability to see and connect things that robotics can't. and its ability to actually care and dive deep. You know, we will give more to somebody that as a leader, especially, who understands my unique needs, who listens and is compassionate and caring. Well, likewise with coaching, you know, as an advisor, the people you're talking about will be advisors. And I can plug things in now to Genie or ChatGPT or whoever, whatever system I want to use. And it will tell me, here's what you should do, Adrian. You should do this, this, and this. Great. An advisor who has wisdom, who has seen things in their swim lane, as we said earlier, is going to give me knowledge that I can't get even from all the accumulation. So there's always going to be a place for that. But we can't fight it. We have to realize it's coming and don't fight the knowledge part of things. But I love the, you know, your term, you know, it's the attention economy. It's, you know, how do we develop our EQ? Because that's what people will buy from us in the future.
Nice. Very nice. I'm sure along the way on your journey, you have lessons to share, lessons that impacted you positively or negatively. Anything you would like to share with our audience?
Well, one of the things I mentioned earlier, we were in the corporate world. We were doing very well. We were making lots of money. I think in the company of 1,700 people, Chester was the second highest paid. I was the fourth highest paid. We should have stayed there forever. We had lots of autonomy. We could go kind of do what we wanted to do. We were the best in the world at what we did, and we were miserable. And don't ignore those feelings. If you are frustrated, it's, you know, you mentioned earlier, Ellie, the sort of the golden handcuffs that keep you there, the financial side. No, we are so much happier because we went and pursued our passions. Yeah, 2020 came and it was a hard year, but we still made enough to pay our mortgages and get through the hard years. But we've also had amazing years. But most importantly is we get to choose the clients we work with. We get to choose who we hire and who we work with, who we interact with. And we began that before we left because we knew, yeah, we're not happy here, but it was still a great company we worked for. It's still a really, there's nothing wrong with the company. It just wasn't the place for us. So life is short. Yes. Make sure your work matters. And find a place where you can feel valued, you feel like you're making a difference, and you feel like you're recognized for the work that you contribute. If you're there right now, stay and love it and keep growing and developing. Push yourself to learn more, have a learning mentality. But if you're not, then work on it. Work now. Don't leap into the unknown. Work today, 1 hour a week even, to get to the next place.
Perfectly said, perfectly said. I think the key that you mentioned is do not ignore the signs. And I see it a lot. I mean, we've got a lot of groups here. We're pretty socially active with the social network, with the cycling network, with the sports network, with whatever network, school network. And I meet a lot of these friends. And the amount of frustration or the amount of, you know, comments that I hear negatively that people are enduring in the workplace, they need to change something. And if they don't change, it means they accept it, right? So that's unfortunate. So it's when you start identifying the signs and feeling the signs, I think it's time to start doing something about it. Sounds like what you've done is you first thing you've done is, okay, let's home in on my mission. What is my ambition? What do I want to do? I mean, I want to branch out. I want to offer to the world more knowledge. I want to capitalize on whatever I amassed. I want to be happy, but also I want to contribute to the larger good of the world. So start with a mission, define it, refine it, and then see if you have authority or if you can claim authority and credibility, because that's the other piece that you have to work on it. If you don't have it, or it's not going to be visible, you need to start working on it. Read, research, learn, take a course, engage with somebody, take a coach. Start developing that. I had one podcast with a young entrepreneur, and his journey was fantastic. He had to really learn a lot to claim credibility in the domain that he is in, because it wasn't in his lane. It wasn't in his swim lane. He had to branch out, but he had a great idea and he had to claim credibility. So he was resilient. He was following a lot of courses, a lot of knowledge acquired to be able to speak properly to senior people, to conferences, and claim authority. And of course, when you finish that, then you start putting it out in the open as a visible. And you just happen to be discovered with that,
there's some luck in it. Yeah.
Exactly. So some luck might come their way. Somebody would listen to their pitch. Somebody would listen to their idea and they'll say, hey, why don't we join hands together? And the rest is history, right?
And it's, everything you're saying, you know, I encourage people to pick up a copy of Reimagining You, because you're laying it out exactly right. And I will say, too, a lot of people are so worried about, I don't have the authority. And I remember when I was back in my corporate world, we brought in a speaker to speak to our salespeople, and he was a sales guru. The company spent a lot of money bringing him in, around like $40,000. So he was a high level, high impact speaker. And we all listened to him tell us all on sales, and everybody thought it was great. And I asked him afterwards, so what's your pedigree? Like, what's your background? He says, well, I used to sell t-shirts. I was like, we just paid $40,000 to listen to a t-shirt salesman. But he just claimed that. So one of the things I deal with a lot is I deal with a lot of speakers and authors that, you know, I'm ghostwriting their books, and imposter syndrome is a big thing too, mm-hmm. where people go, oh, I'm not as cool as Ellie. Look, he's got a PhD. He's got this, you know, he's written a book. He's so cool. It's like, okay, just claim some credibility because you have some, and quit feeling like you're an imposter. Go out there, be confident after you know, you're exactly right. What is my mission? Mine is to help leaders build great workplace cultures. That's my mission. I'm starting to have credibility around it. But when I first started writing about culture, we'd done nothing around culture. Everything had been around employee engagement, employee recognition. But we just said, we're hearing a lot about culture. I'm going to write about it. And we wrote a book on culture that sold 150,000 copies. You know, just like sometimes just go do it. Quit being so scared. Quit having imposter syndrome. Realize you're just as good as anyone else, and you should have a voice. So that would be my charge to people.
I love that. By the way, I mean, Leading with Gratitude is a fascinating book. You know, I read through the eight principles. Absolutely. And they're all fantastic. And I think everybody can take those and apply them at the workplace. Being a leader, you apply those. It's not only saying thank you. Thank you is one of them, but there is another seven that they could benefit from. And my next post on LinkedIn will be about leading with gratitude. So it'll be tomorrow, the day after.
Because it's a fascinating one.
And I will let you know so you can comment on it.
Thanks. That'd be great. Yeah. Wonderful.
Adrian, it was a pleasure. Thank you for your engagement. Thank you for your insights. I appreciate that and appreciate your time. And on behalf of the audience, thank you.
Well, thank you, Ellie, for all you're doing for all of us who want to keep reimagining ourselves. So thank you. And thanks, everybody, for listening to me today as well. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for listening to Reimagining You. If you enjoyed the episode, follow the show, leave a review, and share it forward. See you next week with a new episode. Keep reimagining you.